Some things shouldn't be transparent, like stop signs. But what you pay for should always be clear, like Hiller's True Transparency Pricing, always clearly itemized and never any hidden fees. Because you have the right to know what you're paying for. For more information, visit happyhiller.com/truetransparencypricing. Happy you'll be if the service is free.
Call the Happy Face Truck today.
Big show coming up today. Jeff Mockin will join us. That will be at 12:15. Just prior to the Army head coach coming on, MTSU's head coach Rick Stocks will be on at 11:50. They're taking on FAU and Lane Kiffin down in Boca Raton. And we kick off the 11 a.m. hour talking some college football with Godfrey.
Stephen Godfrey, our guy from Banner Society, bannersociety.com. He's also the host of Podcast Ain't Played Nobody, which is a terrific name for a podcast. I have to read this description, Godfrey, because it really struck me. Hosted by Stephen Godfrey, Podcast Ain't Played Nobody shows you parts of the college football universe you might not have even considered, explains how the machinery that keeps the sport going operates or fails, takes new and different angles on the national storylines, and explains why the standard angles exist in the first place. That, my friend, is a beautifully written description of a podcast. Well done. I don't know if you did that or one of your staffers did that, but that's really well done.
I have never heard that, but I will take credit for it.
Yeah, it's
first time I've heard that description. It's very good.
It's really well done. So Tennessee loses by 29 points in the end to Georgia.
Yeah.
Yet you leave the game maybe more encouraged than going into it with Brian Maurer, even though Georgia covered the spread in that game. That's certainly a statement on what Tennessee football is in 2019. But is there some validity to, okay, maybe now there could be a little bit of optimism with the remaining schedule after Alabama?
Well, I think the better idea would be to apply that to Mississippi State, because I think what we're seeing with Georgia now that we're about kind of halfway through the season is that they are very, very reminiscent of the Alabama, we used to call it the slow cooker offense. It's basically every Alabama offense that Nick Saban has had before Lane Kiffin was his OC. So Georgia's going to start slow. They're going to get methodical. I think Tennessee looked great and effective at times. Obviously, the talent disparity, and I mean, it was a total inevitability that Georgia would win that game. I'm still a little curious if the start Tennessee got off to was because Georgia sort of allows for that in the way that they're playing offense right now. There's a lot of people who are upset by Georgia's offense in the UGA community. I think it's been very different. I thought it was really interesting to see how Jim Chaney called plays against his old team. I think we should apply an evaluation of Tennessee to what happens against Mississippi State specifically. I think that's where you need to go.
Well, let's talk about Mississippi State, because Joe Moorhead's in a weird spot. He's got all these guys serving multiple game suspensions, and the way he's going about it is almost like he looks like he's conceding certain games and then making all the guys eligible in games he thinks that he can win. Looks like they're going to be eligible against Tennessee, certainly a game they're favored to win by about a touchdown. What do you think about sort of what's going on this year with Mississippi State and what they are this year after a lot of big-time losses to the NFL from a year ago?
It's really interesting because he's doing one of two things every time he starts those players. By the way, it's 10 players that will miss 8 games. Okay, so it's like a math problem if you want to write that out. And then you go against an SEC schedule and you look at the 10 players. And really, what you're talking about are a couple key defensive guys. No one more so than Willie Gay, who's maybe the best at his position in the entire league. They're doing two things when they play them. They're either saying, we kind of need them to get over the hump, or we absolutely we have to have you for a rivalry game, because I do believe that they will play against Ole Miss. That game has such an outsized importance for Mississippi State's schedule. When they don't play them, I think they're doing two things. They're either saying, we can beat you without them, which was really interesting because they didn't play against Kansas State and lost. Or they're saying, you know what, we give up, which is what I think they're doing with Alabama, LSU, against Auburn. They got smoked. So when they do play, I think that, you know, I'll be honest, I think Joe Moore has sat down and looked at the schedule and said, let's play them against Tennessee instead of Kansas State. That's the more important game. We feel like it's winnable if everybody's starting and it's a conference game. And I think the decision was made between Tennessee and Kansas State to start these guys.
What is going on with Vanderbilt this year? You've got a situation now where you put up 6 points on an Ole Miss defense that typically gives up a lot of points. And you have Kalijah Lipscomb after the game saying, yeah, it's time to hit the panic button based on how this team is playing and what they're doing offensively.
Well, I mean, I would say that if you give up that many points on offense, and I'm not a big fan of total yardage. It's a very deceptive stat. But when you break it down, Ole Miss rushed, I think, for close to 400, over 400 yards. Something obscene. They basically did not throw the ball, and they went very Rich Rodriguez, like West Virginia Rich Rodriguez, to beat Vanderbilt. That's not something that we associate with Vanderbilt's defense in the Derek Mason era. Ole Miss has essentially no offensive line and no pass game to speak of. If you cannot isolate those two pretty big factors and win a football game in this conference, you are unequivocally bad. I think they are unequivocally bad. Do they make a change with a guy who was being interviewed for other jobs a year ago? Do they make a change with a guy who's beaten Tennessee 3 times in a row? I think these are really, really important questions to ask. I don't have the answer to any of them, and I'm not here to give you like a take, a yes or no, but let me wade into an area that I don't know a lot about, and that's basketball. I, just as a Nashville resident, I noticed the firing of Bryce Drew. Let's put it that way, right? I think a lot of athletic directors in a lot of different circumstances would have just said, all right, the guy's clearly starting from scratch. He's rebuilding. When Malcolm Turner went in there, he did not say that. Clearly they evaluated and said, no, we are going to create a tolerance level. The floor and the ceiling of our program are going to be different. We don't know what the ceiling of our program is going to be. We know the floor is going to be raised. Would he do the same thing for Derek Mason, a guy he did not hire, who he has no connection towards? I don't think it's outside of the realm of possibility.
Well, and Godfrey, it always seems like it's this chicken and egg scenario at Vanderbilt. You know, and let's take the Bryce Drew part of it. Do you invest the resources necessary to compete at a high level and make sure you're doing everything possible to win in the big sports in the SEC? And let's face it, the big sports in the SEC are football and a ways past that, men's basketball. So are you investing enough to win, or do you just need that dynamic coach first and then get the wins rolling? And then the investment will follow, a la James Franklin.
The
success of James Franklin. Well, and it didn't follow to the level they wanted, but for Vanderbilt standards, it followed a bit. And I guess that's – but you're right. For the rest of the SEC, it really didn't follow. So we're going to discuss this later on the show with a big topic. I just don't know what the answer is at Vanderbilt, because I'm with you. It's difficult to fire a guy who's at least doing a little bit of something. I know it's 6 years and he hasn't had a winning record, but the 3 straight wins over Tennessee, if he's playing the hand that's dealt him at Vanderbilt right now, at what time do you up the hand, I guess, is what I'm saying? Or do you say, let's get a dynamic guy in who's going to score a bunch of points or win more games or do something different, then we'll play a bigger hand?
I do. The only criticism I have of Mason is not in football in any way, shape, or form. Like, they have a bad offense this year, but, it's, you know, there was going to be some roster turnover. These things happen, okay? I'm a little shocked the defense is not carrying the team to some degree a little bit better. Losing to Ole Miss to me is a much bigger, bigger sign of a system failure than anything that happened against Georgia or LSU. Those are otherworldly teams. We can all agree on that, okay? When we see them play Missouri, Kentucky, Tennessee, then we'll start to understand who they really are, where they really kind of stand in the scheme of things. But as far as the larger program at Vanderbilt, if you don't know who you are, if you're not honest with yourself about who you are, you'll fail every time. Positively, negatively, like if you over or under invest in yourself. You know, it's funny because most of college football is caught with these programs and boosters and crazy people who think that Mississippi State and North Carolina State and Baylor and et cetera should be winning national titles. Okay? We know that that's just mathematically, we know that's not possible. We know that there is a given limit for teams, most teams, that never really touches playoff contention. And the playoff itself, I think, is designed to discriminate against most of the teams in college football. We know that too. Vanderbilt, I think, has the opposite problem. I think Vanderbilt doesn't understand they're actually undervaluing themselves. Maybe they don't know how to value themselves correctly, and I certainly think they don't know how to catalyze support and interest, and honestly, they need to get a little crazy. They need to get a little invested. They need to get a little irrational and emotional. because dumb people with a lot of money made college football where it is today. So maybe, I know they got money, maybe they need more dumb people.
Smyrna, 104.5 FM. Franklin, 104.5 FM. Murfreesboro, 104.5 FM. No matter where you listen in Middle Tennessee, you'll always find us on one frequency. 104.5 The Zone.
Coming up, The Truth According to Kirby and the Chad Pruitt Show, Thursday edition here. Midday 180 served up by Wendy's. Some of the $5 biggie bag. Godfrey with us.
So, Godfrey, it feels like right now, certainly we've got a situation where there are haves and have-nots in college football. We've had that for as long as college football has been around. But it really seems like there's only six or seven programs, or I should say situations, that could realistically win a national title. And I'm talking about the obvious ones, Alabama, Georgia, throw LSU in there, Ohio State, Oklahoma, Clemson. But you look around college football, and I am curious, Oklahoma, Texas this weekend. I don't see Texas with Tom Herman as a situation that could win a national championship right now. It's certainly a program that could get in the mix quickly. But what do you think about the setup now of those? It's both program, location, setup, and head coach and coaching staff that combines with everything to give them a shot. Is Texas close to being in that mix of six or seven?
If you're asking if they're in national title contention right now, no, I think that's ahead of schedule. So there's expectation reality sort of math formula, if you want, with some of these programs. Yeah, Texas is a national title caliber team. They just have not been. I mean, essentially everything Oklahoma is and the consistency in which they run both of their systems, both sides of the ball, especially after they fired Mike Stoops, and then the way they recruit, that's what Texas should be doing. They should be like a 50-50 sort of share of that territory in the United States in recruiting and that style of offense. They're not, I mean, they're on schedule, I think, especially, I don't really sleep on the bowl win against Georgia the way some people might. I think that they're going to be fine, and I think they're a title contender maybe in like the 2021 seasons, but no, I have not seen a lot of talk of Texas being a national title contender this year, but I know if they beat Oklahoma, people are going to want to put them back in the conversation. I don't see that, because guess what? They're probably going to have to beat Oklahoma twice to do that, and I don't think they can do that.
Yeah, and I'm not saying they're one this year. I'm saying if you're looking at situations right now, I'm talking about program, head coach, conference, everything else, that's set up to be a national championship contender, is Texas with Tom Herman set in that direction right now?
Yeah, definitely. I just think that this – I mean, there's line play issues. They've had talent discrepancies, let's say. I'm going to be honest with you. I bought in on Charlie Strong in Texas in a big way. He would come on late in these recruiting periods, and he would bring in Texas signing level class. You know, it looked appropriate. Let me put it that way. When they hired Charlie Strong, I thought it was a great idea. I went down there, did a story on Charlie Strong, spent some time with him. There were some hiccups, definitely, but I think the transition that they were in, modernizing a lot of aspects of that program, I thought it was working. What I think we know now is that the development under Charlie Strong was a completely different case, and that roster has a really wide range in that you have a lot of talented kids. This has been a Texas problem for years. You have five stars all over that roster, right? You don't really have depth developed, and you don't have defensive talent the way that you should. I think a great comparison is just like the way the LSU game ends, that it comes down to a deeper bench if it was a basketball game. And so I still think that they're a year away from punching their weight. The problem is they're Texas, and so if they're 4-0 or they're 5-1, everybody wants to include them in the conversation almost as a default.
Help me understand this, Godfrey. So you had the Texas player mention something about Hurts thinking that he's played in big games, but he's never played in the Red River Shootout at the Cotton Bowl. And, I just kind of roll my eyes and laugh. I got a chuckle out of it. And then that's all I chalked it up to. And then I read Tim Callishaw and Kevin Sherrington from the Dallas Morning News, and they agree with that he hasn't played in a bigger game than what he'll play on Saturday. How can they say that?
They're pandering to their bases. I mean, let's see. I mean, it's the same thing Feinbaum does every day. There's no difference. I'll tell you this. If you're talking about atmosphere, I didn't play college football, but I have stood on the sidelines for the duration of a Iron Bowl and the Red River 3 years ago. I will say aesthetically, there's nothing like Red River. Aesthetically, it just looks cool. You know, the old stadium is so much tighter, and it just kind of sits in on you. Yeah. I think it's louder, too. I think it's louder than these big modern stadiums. It's just cool. It's an amazing experience, and every college football fan should try and go to both of these games. Getting into the manhood measurement of them is ridiculous. It means nothing. This kid's been in the playoffs, right? I mean, this kid's been in the – do we all forget this kid's been in the playoffs? Like, come on.
Well, and speaking of the speaking of manhood measurement, your manhood was all over ESPN on the latest edition of the College Football 150, the recruiting episode. I just happened to catch these randomly, just sitting in my recliner at 7 o'clock at night.
The tie wasn't covering everything.
No doubt. But it was amazing. Every time I looked up or heard in the background, you were on there talking about recruiting. So well done. You're everywhere, Godfrey.
I was very shocked that I made it on there. I'm not gonna. Someone texted me a congratulations on it, and it was one of those. Do you guys ever have the situation? It happens a lot in media where someone texts you, but it's just a number, and they're like, "Hey man, you did a good job. I heard you on this, or saw you on this. Great job," but you don't know who it is, right?
Right.
So you didn't save the number in your phone. So I texted back. I was like, "Yeah, I'm so shocked that they blank used me at all." And it was the guy who created the show. And here's why. So I had to backtrack, but I said, look, I wrote this Bagman piece almost 6 years ago, okay? I've been covering the underbelly of college sports pretty much for the duration of that time, okay? When I wrote the piece Crooked Letters about all of the intrigue and backstabbing that went on with the NCAA, the SEC, and the two Mississippi schools, ESPN didn't touch it, okay? ESPN is beholden to the Southeastern Conference and a lot of other powerful entities. And I've gotten used to the fact that I just get ignored. And, like, I think worse than that, and you guys understand what I'm saying, it's like in a media market, when you report something and other people ignore it that are your colleagues, it almost is like they're isolating it from actually feeling like it's real. You know what I'm saying? And so
yes.
I have come to appreciate the fact that ESPN is going to operate on a different wavelength when it comes to a lot of controversies in college football because they are in the business of college football. So to be on that television show, I was shocked. I think I told you guys this off the air. When they flew me out there last year to do the show, I remember walking out. I told my agent, my wife, I was like, that's great. They're not going to use any of this. So I guess, I got a free trip out of it.
Well, and certainly with the NBA's relationship with ESPN, we're seeing that now with everything in China. So that's front and center.
The irony there is that's a tough one. It kind of makes college football players getting a couple thousand dollars not that big a deal when, you know, people are getting run over with tanks and other authoritarian regimes. But, you know, it's okay to play basketball there because it's $1 billion contract. So interesting times.
There's no good way to segue from that to this. But I knew Dan Mullen was going to be a problem for the SEC when he took the Florida job. And that is turning out to be true. Especially the way this team is developing as the year goes on. They look great defensively against Auburn.
Yeah. I think that you want to talk about something I didn't expect to say this year? I think the credit goes to Grantham, actually, the defensive coordinator, because Florida fans will be the first to tell you that they have not experienced the typical third and Grantham situation, which is what he had issues with when he's been, you know, he had issues with it at Florida, Georgia, Louisville, Mississippi State, everywhere he's been. His blitzing has been tactful. His pressures have been very smart. Now, I will say this, and I'm not trying to dampen what they've done. When you look at the hiccup against Kentucky, a game they should have lost, you know, college kickers, right? Auburn had a freshman quarterback. Auburn protected the heck out of its freshman quarterback and had a very fortuitous moment in the winning drive against Oregon. They beat up on a less talented Mississippi State team. Maybe we're coming back to earth on Auburn. They are now, talking about Florida, they are going to be tested by an LSU offense that is as real as anything we know about halfway through a college football season, inarguably. So I think they're good. I think they're great. I think they're gonna give Georgia everything that they want in the cocktail party. I still like LSU in this game.
Want to be at Nissan Stadium this fall?
Touchdown! Titans.
Tune in for Titans Ticket Tuesday, sponsored by Kentucky Legend. Each Tuesday before Tennessee Titans home games this season, you can win a pair of tickets to the next Titans game at Nissan Stadium, courtesy of 104.5 The Zone and Kentucky Legend, the preferred hot dog of the Tennessee Titans. Listen for your chance at 7 a.m., 12 p.m., and 5 p.m. each Tuesday before the Titans take on their next opponent in Nashville. More info at 104.5thezone.com/contests.
Come with a $5 piggyback live at Gupton Motor, Dodge, Chrysler, Jeep, Ram, 3450 Tom Austin Highway here in Springfield. And we literally were on our way out to hand some money to someone to go grab us some $5 piggybacks down the street here from Gupton. And Ellen arrived as Chad was about to hand the money off for someone to make a run for us with the $5 piggybacks for us.
Ellen, who drives a Gupton Jeep, she let us know. I see her right now in her Jeep in Robertson County in Cross Plains. Heard us, and she delivered. What a sweetheart.
How did she approach
you? And is a big
fan
of the show. Well, I walked out, and I saw I saw Taryn with promotions. He was out there talking with her, and I saw her going to her car, and she said, "Are there two of them?" And he said, "Yes." So I was walking the cash to Taryn to go get us some food, and I said, "Wait a minute, what's going on here?" And I turn around, and she's pulling bags of Wendy's out of her Jeep. So I said, "Oh, well, okay, well, this is taken care of. Thank you so much." That was a very generous and kind move.
Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you, Ellen.
Midday 180 shirt headed your way.
Every time we come to Springfield, we think of Ellen.
Yeah, we will.
It's in commemoration, a celebration of Ellen every time we come to Robertson County.
And every Thursday on the show, we think of Godfrey, who joins us.
I never get free food when I come to the studio.
You just got to ask for it. You just throw it out there and someone might bring it to you.
Man.
I was saying during the break to Chad Godfrey, it's hard to believe that James Franklin is in his sixth season at Penn State already.
Yeah. It's
5-0. How legit is this state team right now?
I don't know if we're even going to find out against Iowa. If you look at Penn State, actually, if you look at the top end of the Big Ten in general, when they go to Iowa City, like we saw Iowa score 3 points in Ann Arbor last weekend. They don't tend to travel well against the truly elite programs in the Big Ten. But when you go into Iowa City, they make you play Iowa football. And so Penn State may have another ugly half or even three quarters and win the game on Saturday. So I think that's going to keep them off of a lot of people's radar. I think just the way that the conference is set up, I don't think we're going to know about Penn State for a while, possibly. That Ohio State game, by the way, is not until, next to the last season. Next to the last week of the season. So they're going to be one of those teams we get to debate for a while. They're very good. I was with those coaches in the spring, and they obviously have some pretty key pieces on offense they're transitioning out of. I still think they're looking for an offensive identity that would be comparable to what Joe Moorhead had going on there with McSorley and Saquon. But they're a really good defense, and Brent Pry has done a fantastic job as a defensive coordinator there. I don't think he gets credited enough as being a top DC in college football, and a guy who has very quietly been mentioned for and offered some head coaching jobs and just kind of sticks around. Kind of reminds me of Dave Aranda in that regard at LSU. So I think they're very good. I think we could be headed towards undefeated versus undefeated with them in Ohio State in November.
Is Wake Forest and their success, they're 5-0 right now, is this simply a byproduct of a really weak ACC, or is Dave Clawson really getting something done there?
Yeah, so we talk about this a lot on our podcast because I have a Florida State guy, Bud Elliott, who's a recruiting reporter. And, you know, do you guys remember when Wake Forest won the Orange Bowl? That was a strange occurrence, right? That was, you know, we call it sort of the canary in the coal mine, or is this a symptom of sickness for a conference? Like, when you see Baylor and TCU as the top teams in the Big 12, or Wake Forest going to the Orange Bowl, or, you know, I'm trying to think of another good example, even Utah being, you know, considered one of the most dominant teams in the Pac-12, is that a school building up on its own merit, or is that a symptom that the overall product in that conference is actually down? I think in Wake's case, it's a little bit of column A, but it's a lot of column B, and I think that this is a bad league, guys. This is not a good league. This league has one program that might be the best or second or third best program in the United States, and then that's about it, right? We're seeing system failures at Virginia Tech. We're seeing a total year zero mode at Georgia Tech. We are seeing maybe, what do we want to call it, year 0.5 for Willie Taggart at Florida State. Miami is vexing. They're so bad. You look around, and this is why programs like Wake Forest have good seasons. I hate to say that, because I think Dave Clawson has provided a really nice blueprint for what a lot of schools should be doing, and that's, you need to hire a guy who's got good credentials, get out of his way, and don't bother him for, like, how many years has he been there now?
I think this is six, maybe? Five or six?
Yeah. You know who it reminds me of is the Mark Stoops trajectory at Kentucky. I think there's a lot of comparisons that you can make there. And now the difference is this. Wake is sort of a contender right now underneath Clemson, right? Wake and Virginia are being talked about as possibly the second best teams in the ACC. Kentucky had an all-world year last year, and they were, where would they rank in the SEC overall?
Six. Double digits, for
okay.
sure.
Like, I mean, I'm talking about last year, like when they
did and
beat Penn State, you know, on New Year's Day, like fifth, maybe, right? Maybe, okay? So that's the difference when you talk about quality in conference play, and it's also why, and I hate to reinforce an SEC talking point, but that's why some people's 8-4 is different than some people's 10-2. So I think Wake is definitely a sign of the ACC's weakness, but also you really have to hand it to them because they did exactly what you're supposed to do at a program like that. I talked about it in the earlier segment. Know who you are as a program and embrace that identity. That's going to lead to the right and rational amount of success, and that's exactly what the Deacs have done.
Is what's going on at Memphis sustainable, or is this simply a Fuente following up with Norvell window that we're in? Were they going to have some success, or was this always a sleeping giant type program that could be really good in the group of five?
I think it was always a program that could be really good in the group of five. They didn't. They received virtually no attention at all for the better part of two decades, as that was 110% a basketball school. They played in a pretty decrepit facility that's since had a couple cursory facelifts, and it's a little bit better. But the bottom line is, like, the last time I was there, it was Fuente's last year before he got hired by Tech, and like, I mean, he pulled out a map, and you look at what's available to recruit underneath the SEC even, and not only that, but I mean, recruit and fight the Mississippi schools, recruit and fight Arkansas, recruit and fight even Tennessee on some guys. I'm not saying you win, but they go in there with that mentality, and then what you're left with is a really, really good roster. And so this was a grossly undervalued property. This is a distressed property, as they say in real estate, and they were able to flip it. What's interesting to me is they're now probably going to get their expectations out of whack because they didn't invest too much into football other than making good coaching hires, and now they're just going to expect that that's the norm. Kind of reminds me of South Florida, actually, because South Florida has invested nothing in infrastructure, nothing in resources, and just expects you to win 10 games a year because you're in Tampa. That could be the path that Memphis is headed down.
Where are you headed this weekend?
I'm home after last week. I was on assignment in a very unique place. I've got to go up to New York soon for some meetings. So I'm home. I will be headed out to see a couple more coaches for a couple upcoming projects. But I'm starting. You know where I'm going to be for the next couple weekends is on the phone, because coaching season, I feel like, is close to upon us. You talk about Vanderbilt for a second. If they drub UNLV, that job I think might open very, very soon. And I think the dominoes are going to start to fall as we get into the silly season.
Can't wait for the silly season. Godfrey, appreciate it, man. We'll catch up next week.
I'll be in studio next week. Thanks, guys.